Looking for more McGinnis on Tap? You found it.
And we welcome you back to McGinnis on Tap, as promised. Right out of the 18th tower and down to the radio booth. That is such a fall in such a short period of time.
I couldn't wait to get here.
Brando Shipley joining us now.
It's been a long time since I chewed the fat with you.
I mean
that metaphorically.
Clearly I've chewed far too much fat lately. Generally, I would offer you a beverage, but the folks at XM frown on such things.
I'm minutes away from a beverage.
I'm a full 2 hours away from one.
Well, I'll text you and tell you how it tastes.
But who's counting? Brando, it's great to see you. I've actually tried to get you on the show several times now. You're always busy. Do you like what you're doing now? I mean, are you excited about coming to work? They let you do so many different things.
That's exactly right. I could go into the studio and pretty much do whatever I want to do, you know, as long as it has something to do with golf.
Right.
But you know, if I walk in there and I say, look, I want to do a swing breakdown of Michael Thompson, Billy Horschel, or whoever it may be, they give me a lot of leeway, and they've got great tools there because they have a wonderful video library of every golf shot hit for the last 30 or 40 years. So you can sort of dive in there from a player's aspect. I can go in there for selfish reasons and
right.
look at the different swings of players and learn a lot. And hopefully the idea is that that'll help me at some point in my analysis. But I love it. I absolutely love it.
Well, before we start talking about this tournament and other players, by my calculations, July 2nd next year is going to be a decision-making day for you in that you turn 50 years old.
I do, July 2nd. Unfortunately, that is just too far. I think May is the cutoff to be able to go to qualifying school for the Champions Tour, so I can't go this year. I'll have a few exemptions based on my status, but not many. And I'll try and play in the qualifying school. I mean, I will play in the qualifying school, and I'll hopefully play a few events. I mean, I'm not quitting my job. I love this job. I love what I'm doing.
Well, that was the next question.
I'd love to try and do
both. I mean, if you could do like what Kurt did when he turned 50, Kurt Byram, mm-hmm. he played a handful of events, looked at it and said, boy, these guys are still really good.
Well, yes. I mean, first of all, they're really good, and they're really hungry. You know, what Gary McCord did coming out of the booth was pretty impressive. But Gary plays golf every single day. I mean, that guy loves golf. He plays when he's home. His kids had already grown up and gone. So when he'd go home, he'd go to the golf course and play and practice with all those young guys. I've got three pretty young kids, 14, 9, and 8. So I'm busy when I go home, and I don't have a whole lot of time to practice.
Are they golfers?
A little bit. They play. My oldest plays football. He plays hockey. They all play a little golf, tennis. My middle son, he plays basketball. He plays everything, violin, piano, all that fun stuff. But I take them to the golf course. They get bored pretty quick, and you know, they're happy driving the cart and, you know, running around, getting in bunkers or whatnot. But it hasn't caught yet, the golf.
My 9-year-old daughter says you have to be quiet way too long and there's no snacks.
It's exactly why I didn't take up golf till I was 13. And my dad was like, shh, quiet. I was like, well, why do I want to do this?
So you came to it late?
I did. My dad took me out when I was 8 or 9. But there were too many rules and you had to be quiet. And, you know, so about 13, 14, another friend of mine took me out to play, and I loved it. You know, at that time I had 6 horses, and I was riding rodeos and play days, and I came home, and I said, I love golf. Want to play golf? My dad was like, that's all right. Well, you're going to sell those horses then, because they're darn expensive, and we're not going to do 2 expensive hobbies. So I sold the horses and went into golf, and you know what? It's been a great life.
Looking at your playing career, do you have is there some emptiness there, or you know, you won Vancouver, one of my favorite events, on a terrific golf course? Do you think, boy, I really wish I could have gotten a half a dozen wins, or are you able to say I did all I could do, and the circumstances in my private life and other things said, okay, this is it?
No, I think everybody, and it doesn't matter whether you win once or 5 or 10 or 20 times, feels like you left a lot out there on the table. Davis Love won 20 times. He finished second 30. So, you know, while I'm going to, you know, piss and moan a little bit about, you know, only getting one win, lost a couple of playoffs and a few other close calls, and felt like I was robbed of a few tournaments and gave a few away, he could have won 50 times or 40 times or 30 times. But you know, I had a ball. Every single time I teed it up, I felt like I was living a privileged life, playing a game. I was my own boss and playing beautiful golf courses and meeting beautiful people. So, You know, I don't look back on what I did as a professional golfer with any regret whatsoever. I gave it my all. I enjoyed it. I had a blast. And you know what? I may jump back in there at 50 and have another run at competitive angst a little bit and see how far I go.
I remember the first few years of my career, and that started on the PGA Tour in 96. Every time I went to the driving range, you were there. You worked as hard as anybody. I mean, you know, Vijay gets so much credit for the hard work that he's put in, and he deserves the credit.
Right.
But there's plenty of other guys out there grinding away at it, and you were one of them.
Well, I loved it. It was funny. Not that long ago, I was looking at the list of the top 100 teachers, and I darn near had a lesson from every one of them. and it wasn't so much that I was searching, because I pretty much around 92 or 3 was pretty comfortable with my golf swing, but I love to talk golf, and I love to talk golf swing. So I would seek out Jim Flick and learn from him. You know, I would seek out David Ledbetter or Randy Smith or Butch Harmon or Craig Shanklin or whoever it may be, and just talk golf with them. I really enjoyed it. I was lucky enough to go to school at the University of Texas and caught Harvey Pinnock for a few years and was around him a lot. And listened to and watched him give some lessons. So I've always enjoyed the process of, you know, of hitting golf balls and talking about and looking at golf swings. And besides that, if I left the golf course, I'd just go spend money. So I wasn't going to spend any money on the driving range.
That's a good point.
They didn't have internet then. You know?
That's true.
For the most part.
Most of us didn't have cell phones.
That's
couldn't
right.
afford them.
That's right. So our wives couldn't get a hold of us. I don't know where he's at. He's on the range hitting balls. I hope that's where he's at.
All right. Let's talk about what everybody wants me to ask you about. And that's how did you come to the decision as a broadcaster or an analyst to say, you know what, I'm going to lay it all on the line. Was there a moment of was there an epiphany there that you said, I'm going to go ahead and say what's on my mind?
Yeah, there was. You know, I got into broadcasting early on, and it sounds funny, but the hardest thing to do as a broadcaster is be yourself. And you know, it took me, you know, the first few years, I don't know who I was trying to be or what I was trying to do. I was in a sort of an uncomfortable spot my first couple of years, and didn't want to step on any toes, and didn't want to say the wrong thing.
Didn't you jump right in with ABC?
I did.
That's a tough situation.
I jumped right in with ABC. It wasn't the best of circumstances from a comfort standpoint, but you know, I can remember having ideas of things I wanted to do, and you know, as a hole announcer, then I wasn't an analyst at that point. You know, there wasn't a whole lot I could do, basically. And so my role was somewhat limited. When I moved to the Golf Channel, it opened up some avenues for me to analyze some things and to talk more broadly about every subject that comes up in the game of golf. And as time went on, I got more and more comfortable. And, you know, I spent a lifetime studying and reading about every little thing there was in the game of golf. And, you know, I can remember about 3-4 years into it. And this is funny, because early on, I'd run into Mike Tirico, and I'm going to tell you, I stunk at TV. And I stunk at everything that had to do with talking. And Tirico said, you know, look, it's going to take you 5, 6, 7 years to find your comfort level. He was very encouraging. He goes, I like the things you're doing. I like the way you do it. And he said, but it's going to take you a while to find your comfort level. And somewhere about 4 or 5 years into it, I was doing a show at the Masters, second or third round. And I walked off the show, and it occurred to me that I didn't think once, not one time did I think about what I was going to say. I didn't think, I prepare for shows very hard, but the light went on and I was just myself. And so all the research could just come out organically. You know, I didn't go into shows thinking about what I was going to say or how I was going to say it, which can shut you down and stifle you. So I just came out of that show, and I was like, you know what? That's comfortable. And I decided, since it's not like golf where you hang a number on the board and nobody can tell you you didn't play well, TV is a very subjective business. And, you know, it's a visual business. So if you can't add to what's going on TV, then shut up. When people say you're paid to talk, well, when you do live TV, I'm like, well, no, you're paid as much to shut up and know when to shut up as you are to talk. But when I quit trying to think about what I was going to say and how I was going to say it, and I just watched the screen, reacted to what happened. If I couldn't add to it, then shut up. But in the studio, I had a lot of leeway to do whatever I want to do and however I want to do it. And I've come to realize that I can prepare as hard as I want, and when the light comes on, have fun. Because if I have fun, that's pretty much how I judge a good show, because I'm generally going to be loose and I'm going to let it fly.
And so when you get criticism, whether it's from other members of the media or golf fans or even the players, does it just roll off your back at this point?
Well, if you know, when I get criticism or criticized from players, I will say, what did you hear? And was I wrong? Because I don't, I come by opinions based upon digging through and looking at numbers and empirical evidence. And so I come by my opinions and ideas trying to connect the dots, always trying to answer the question why, because the audience can see what just happened. It's my job to say why it happened.
Right.
And at least give a reasonable assumption as to why it happened. And I'll spend a lot of time coming up with those ideas and opinions. And so when they criticize me, I'll say, was I wrong? And if they say I was wrong, I'll say, how was I wrong? And if they tell me I was wrong, and in fact, I made an error, I apologize. But mostly, their golf pros are pretty darn sensitive.
Well, golf pros are definitely sensitive. Yeah. But I think more importantly than that, they're getting their information secondhand or third hand.
That's right.
Their agent is calling them and saying,
that's right,
did you hear what Chambly said about you?
That's right.
And that's a skewed view of what actually took place.
Right. I found this to be very true, and I perhaps I was guilty of it, but I can speak glowingly about somebody for 5 minutes and then say on the back end, but he's a terrible wedge player. And the next time I see him, the guy wants to kill me, and I'll say, well, what'd you hear? Oh, you called me a terrible wedge player. And I was like, well, yes, but before that, I said that, you had a marvelous tempo, best grip I've ever seen, great transition, good footwork, but you need to work on your distance control and your trajectories. And I believe I'm looking at the stats that tell me that's the case, and I believe I've witnessed it. So if I'm, in fact, wrong, I want you to tell me how I'm wrong, because I want to be right. I want to get the information and deliver it succinctly and give the people what they want, information, and connect the dots. Try to help them connect the dots a little bit.
Now, have you gotten to the point, your face is on TV a lot. I know here in a golf community, you're recognized, I would think, just about everywhere you go. But walking through the Orlando airport, do people stop you and say?
Yeah, it's golf fans.
Right.
It's a true golf fans, and they're wonderful people. And, they feel like they know you because you're in their living room every single day, and they want to talk to you about their game or some shot or some comment. It's always nice. It is always it's wonderful. They just want to talk golf and have a quick moment and say hi. But it's certainly not an inconvenience to me in any way.
I asked Mike Ritz that same question. He said, "Yeah, but it's never the people that I want to recognize me."
Well, he might be referring to the feminine guy.
Yes, well,
I'm not sure.
That's Ritzy.
But no, as I always say, you have just the right amount of celebrity in golf. There are not too many people with outside Phil Mickelson or Tiger Woods that have the type of celebrity that causes them to be annoyed by it. It's generally nice people saying nice things.
Jimmy Buffett wrote a song, and in it was the line, "I don't want the fame that brings confusion."
That's right.
And I think that this is a lot less confusing.
I agree.
I have to say, oftentimes I disagree with your opinions, but I always admire the fact that you are going to put them out there. Whatever it is, whether it's a policy of the tour or whatever, that I'd want to debate with you because it would be a fun debate. I think that you've shown courage in your broadcasting that very few of us have attained. I have to express opinions on this show, but it's easier for me to hide behind the microphone because I'm not staring at the camera.
Well, when you go on TV, you're making an argument. It's no different than being in a courtroom. You're stating your case, and you're making an argument. Now, to just throw out an opinion that's not based in any fact or extrapolated fact is dangerous. So when I've got an opinion, and the reason I'm usually pretty forceful with them is I've given them a lot of thought, and I try to find some interesting facts that support that opinion and precedent that supports that opinion. And sometimes there's not precedent for it. In the case of the long putter, you know, there are a lot of people that love it, but there's no precedent for taking something that was legal and getting rid of it. But I don't believe that it should be allowed. I don't think it's golf. It takes a lot of the skill and almost all of the nerves out of the game. At the highest level, there's no place for it. And it's an oversight by the USGA. I believe that the RNA will eventually reconsider it, and this will be a strong point of contention between the RNA and the USGA. It should be banned at the professional level, and it should set a precedent for two sets of rules between professional golf and recreational golf.
I liked what Ernie L. said. I'm going to keep cheating just like all the rest of them
until they make it illegal.
How did the writing come to you? Because that's a part of what you're doing in the media that, and people say the same thing to me. They're surprised that I can form a sentence on paper. but I majored in it. You didn't. How did that come to you? Because your use of words on the page is different than your use of words as you're speaking. I don't mean you specifically. I mean, it's harder to put it on paper.
Yes. And it's, you know, look, I enjoy, you know, people say, what's your ideal day? I mean, if my kids are in school or if I'm on the road, there's really not much I like more than having a cup of coffee and reading a book all day. I've enjoyed it my entire life. And I enjoy reading.
You got to get out more.
I do. And, you know, people will say that to me. And I'm like, you know, I'm happy sitting reading a book at home. I'm very happy sitting in my hotel room reading a book. I'm a bit of a nerd. I read the classics, and I love great literature. I love great poetry. Big fan of the written word. And there are some terrific writers in the history of the golf. Some of the best writers of all time. I mean, Henry Longhurst, of course, but Bernard Darwin, perhaps the greatest sports writer of all time. Herbert Warren Wynn, amazing twist of words. The reason we all talk about supination and pronation is not because those were Ben Hogan's words. People wrongly attribute those words to Ben Hogan. Those words were Herbert Warren Wynn's, explaining to people Ben Hogan's ability to go from a cupped left wrist to a bowed left wrist at impact. Those are not Ben Hogan's words. Those are medical terms that Herbert Warren Wynn knew and gave those to the world of golf, which we all wrongly attribute to Ben Hogan, Herbert Warren Wynn. So Herbert Warren Wynn, Bernard Darwin, Charles Price, and some of today's writers, Jaime Diaz. I love reading Jaime Diaz. I just think he has a wonderful way with words. And, you know, all the way through it, Jeff Rude has been widely acclaimed as a great writer. I enjoy, but that's within sport and golf. I don't follow a lot of other sports, but I do read a great deal of literature, and I love it. And I'm very impressed with somebody that can write on deadline, and I'm very impressed with original turns of phrases. They move me, and so it's something I really enjoy doing. I'm in the process of writing a book about golf instruction. It'll be sort of a historical essay about the best players of all time, but the thing that they did the best. And there'll be some surprises in there as well. So in other words, it'll be about the longest hitters, of course, because everybody wants to know how to do that, but what they had in common, the straightest hitters, what they had in common, best iron players, what they had in common, their commonalities, best wedge players, best putters, best bunker players, the commonalities of the game's greatest players. But there'll be some surprises in there, because when you start talking about the greatest drivers of all time, people think of Jack Nicklaus, and they'll think of Greg Norman, or they'll think of Ben Hogan. Well, I talked to Jack Nicklaus and asked him who he thought the greatest driver of a golf ball ever was, and he told me Dave Thomas. You know who Dave Thomas is?
No.
Of course not. Not many people do. The only reason I do is because my roommate in college was Paul Thomas. Now, his father was a very famous Welsh golfer who played on numerous Ryder Cups. Lost the British Open by a shot in 58, lost it by a shot in 66. Excuse me, he lost in a playoff 58. Lost by a shot in 66 at Muirfield to Jack Nicklaus. He could hit it when 300 yards was a big deal. He could hit it 300, 320 on a line. On a line. So my goal is to have his swing in there. You know, people aren't going to know who he is. And have it, you know, when I start talking about the straightest hitters of all time or the best swings of all time, people say, Tom Pertzer or Steve Elkin. I'm like, aesthetically, yes. But what's your idea of a good swing? You're confusing aesthetics with effect, the results, control. I would argue that Calvin Peet had one of the greatest swings of all time. Nobody hit the ball better than him. And to dismiss it as idiosyncratic is short-sighted.
When you're talking about the best swing being the most productive swing, does he hit it? Did he hit it far enough to fall into that category? Because he was one of the shorter guys out there, but Short was cool then.
Well, Short was 250 then, and Long was 270. There wasn't a huge disparity in distance then. But what Calvin Peet did was hit the ball probably as straight as it's ever been hit in the history of the game. He would go weeks and not miss a fairway. He would go a month. It wasn't unusual for him to hit 100% of the fairways. And year after year after year, he led the driving accuracy. So not to include him amongst the straightest drivers of all time is remiss. So you put his swing up there with, say, Joe Durant and a Fred Funk and a Ben Hogan. Now, Ben Hogan, there's no statistical evidence to say he was the straightest driver of all time. It's anecdotal, and you can extrapolate from results and events. But nonetheless, I think it poses interesting questions. What were their commonalities?
Well, are there guys playing today who we wouldn't expect that fall into some of those categories?
Absolutely. And
Tiger and Phil can – okay, they're going to be included. Phil for the wedge game, maybe.
Right.
Tiger for certainly his putting over a decade and a half.
Well, when you start talking about Tiger, and it's like great bottles of wine or great vintages, you have to be specific as to years. Because Tiger, unlike all other champions, great champions, has had four different golf swings. And the 2010 Tiger cannot compare in any way, shape, or form to the 2000 Tiger. The 2007 Tiger was completely different than the 2003 Tiger. So you have to be specific. Literally, with Tiger, you have to say 2000 to 2002 Tiger. That was the guy who could drive it the longest, the straightest, perhaps, of anybody in the history of the game. And perhaps played the greatest golf of all time. So those golf swings have completely different commonalities than how he swung later. And don't get me wrong, in 2007, he still led the tour in ball striking. He had the exact same scoring average that he had in 2000. He just did it a little bit different way. And so, yes, Tiger will be in there as the longest, straightest driver in a group. But that's a very small group, long, straight. There's very few guys in that group. He'll be in there in 2000. His iron play will certainly be in there, mid-iron play, long iron play. He's in there multiple times. Anybody that's won all five major championships, all four major championships, and there's five of those guys, you have to assume that they had the complete game. And, again, this is another place where history doesn't completely tell the story. I say only five have won all four major championships. They had a way of taking major championships away from players and giving major championships away to players. When the Masters became a major, they dismissed the Western.
Right.
Well, in fact, Tommy Armour won every major championship there was to win. He won the British, he won the U.S. Open, the PGA, and the Western. To not include him as a guy who won every major championship is wrong, and nobody does, but he did. And he'll be in there as well as a great iron player.
Brandon Chambly, I've taken more of your time than I should have.
Not at all. I'm on the road. I don't have kids. So,
I'm sure
it's
the listeners appreciate getting to know you a little better. The problem with what you do in the studio is we only get 4 minutes of you. We've just gotten 20 here, and we appreciate every
pleasure.
One of them.
Always nice talking to you, John. Enjoy your work, and congratulations on your show.
Thank you. I appreciate
Good for
it.
You.
Brandon Chambly, you'll catch him in the 18th Tower tomorrow. Oh, by the way, who's going to win tomorrow?
You know, Webb Simpson is going to be a tough man to beat. He had 33 putts today, but he only missed one fairway, one green. If he putts it all tomorrow, he's going to put a lot of pressure on Billy Horschel, who's and obviously never won before, but he's also 139th on the money list. And if you watched him come down the stretch today, the golf swing got a little bit quick. He's a year or two away from being very comfortable in the position he's in now. And Michael Thompson, I love his rhythm. He does a few things in his golf swing that I think lead to some loose shots. He's got a really strong right-hand grip, takes the club outside, gets it laid off. But he corrects a lot of that with rhythm. He's going to be very interesting to watch. But I think Webb Simpson is going to give those guys in front a very tall task.
I'll tell you, Trevor Immelman, it's been 3 years since he had a top 10. But
that's right.
How can you discount him,
Well, 62, it's tough to follow a 62. I hope he does. He benefited from different conditions. He got to play 15 in downwind, and he just lit those holes up. And the players turned around Billy Horschel, not to take anything away from Trevor Immelman. 62 is a great round. But can he follow it up with another one? I don't know. But I do know that he's one of my top five favorite golf swings. I love watching him. You know, Angel Cabrera, Trevor Immelman, I love their moves. So I'm going to be sitting in a tower watching a guy try to win for the first time. A couple of guys try to win for the first time. Webb Simpson try to overtake the money list. And one of my favorite swings in golf try to follow up a great round. So I'm going to have a good seat and a good time tomorrow.
Absolutely. You know why it's so hard to follow up a 62?
Why?
Because it's so damn hard to shoot a 62 to begin with.
You're right.
You don't get that many chances in your career.
I'll tell you a funny story. The first time my older sister ever watched me play golf, I have five brothers and sisters. They're all into other things. They don't even know what golf. They don't even pay attention to golf. My older sister, I was playing in the Byron Nelson about my seventh year on tour. She was like, I'm going to come out and watch you. So she came out and watched me. I shot 62. The next day, she didn't come watch me. I shot 68. So she called, and I was at my mom and dad's house. She called and said, you know, how did you do? I said, well, I shot 68. And she goes, oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. You disappointed? And I go back. 68 is a good score. Well, it's so much worse than you played yesterday. I was like, man, trust me, I'm happy. You can come watch me play anytime.
That's Brandon Chamblee. This is McGinnis on Tap. We'll be right back.
Always smooth, never dull. It's McGinnis on Tap on the PGA Tour Network.